Hey, and welcome to Top 10 Everything. I'm Jim.
And I'm Swift. Hello.
So, today's list is going to be Top 10 Sci-Fi Movies. This is going to be specifically movies. We are back, live and in color.
Live and in color.
So, I want to just lay something out about science fiction for a second, and sci-fi movies more specifically. I personally don't think there are many good sci-fi movies. I think sci-fi as a genre is fantastic.
Yeah.
But I think it works way better in books, because I think a lot of times what you imagine in your head, when they try to recreate that visually, I think it comes off really cheesy.
It can.
I generally, I don't know, like something like a, well, for starters, I don't want to give away too much, but for me, it's hard to actually find like really good cold sci-fi movies. I think a lot of them just end up being sort of Logan's Run-ish. Good in concept, terrible in execution. Did you ever see Logan's Run?
Yeah, probably a long time ago.
You remember the guy from Austin Powers who was like Austin Powers' boss?
Yeah.
Like, hey, Austin Powers. That's the main character from Logan's Run. Anyways, just wanted to get that out of the way.
That's true. I mean, they're hard to do because...
Yeah,
most of the time, they're all trying to create an entire world every single time. And
then you have to have a movie that has to have the budget to be able to pull that off.
It's hard.
All right, so number 10. Number 10 is the most recent one on the list. It's a movie that just came out. I just saw it. I thought it was fantastic. It's called Ex Machina.
Have you seen this? Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
All right, so I want to explain something about Ex Machina. It's about these two scientists slash engineers, right? This one guy works for this other guy. The other guy is the head of the company, and he selects this other scientist slash engineer to come to his house, basically, which is like secluded in the middle of nowhere, like in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
He says because he's working on a secret project, and he wants this other scientist to work on it with him. It turns out that the head of the company has created a robot, like a full-on working female robot. And he's brought this other guy in because basically he's trying to see if the robot is truly sentient.
Right.
Like he's trying to see the depth of its AI. So they start running tests on her, basically. It's a her, by the way. To see what the level of her AI is. To see basically like how deep her desires go.
Right.
How deep she truly feels real.
How human is she really?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what's really cool about the movie is that I think a lot of times in science fiction movies, we're dealing with the future and we're using it to explain the present day and the morals of the day.
Right.
But a lot of times in those movies, things seem so futuristic and so, you know, far away from us that even though they make philosophical and moral points about the current state of things, a lot of times they just feel foreign.
Right.
Because nothing of it's realistic. As where this movie feels entirely realistic. It really feels like, and because of how far technology is now, that maybe there's a house somewhere out there being run by some Steve Jobs type, some, you know, Mark Zuckerberg
some
type.
Some startup in San Francisco in someone's garage.
Some startup genius.
Yeah.
Or some guy has built a robot, you know? The movie's only basically got three people in the whole thing in one location.
Interesting.
And it's really about the strength of... It's sort of what you would call a bottle movie, which is the idea of a couple characters in one location and then watch the tension rise. So it has this... What's the word when you're afraid of being in one space?
Claustrophobic.
I kept wanting to say catastrophic. Although it does feel at times catastrophic. But the idea... of what makes a robot sentient. And then not only that, is this robot willing to trick you to get freedom? Because basically in this movie, I don't want to give too much away, but this robot's basically imprisoned. She's behind this glass.
Right.
And she's never seen the outside world, but she knows enough that she wants to see it. And the whole time, they're trying to figure out how human is she? It's a fantastic movie. I don't want to give too much of it away because it does have twists and turns. The main actor in it is Oscar Isaac. He played Llewyn Davis inside Llewyn Davis. You know what I'm talking about?
Think so.
He's had a big year. He was also in A Most Violent Year.
I don't know what that is.
Well, the other scientist, the one who he brings to his house, is actually going to be in the new Star Wars.
Oh, cool. Okay.
He was...
Speaking of sci-fi.
Yeah, he was the guy, I think he was in that movie about his dad, which was actually kind of, it was like a science fiction slash father-son slash romantic comedy called About, I think it was called About Time.
About Time?
It was about this father and his son that both travel back in time.
Yeah, it was a British movie, right?
Yeah, it was actually really touching.
Yeah.
I watched it with my wife thinking it was going to be sort of like a romantic comedy that we could both settle on and it would really be mostly for her. And it turned out it was completely mostly for me. Nice. It was like, I was like in tears because it's about fathers and sons and... Anyways.
And time travel, which is great.
And time travel. But it's the same guy. Ex Machina is the most recent one on the list. I think it's a perfect example of how you can take great writing and a little bit of money and go a long way.
Yeah, I mean, it had a good look to it from the trailer.
It's like, so cold.
I wanted to see it.
It's so sleek. The whole movie's so sleek.
I know. What you mean by that is it means it feels sterile.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel warm. The entire movie feels cold and with tension.
Yeah, all right.
That's a good sci-fi should be, really.
Right. So... Number 9, and this is really the oldest movie on the list, but I think I had to include it just because it's such a classic. The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah, that's a classic. Yeah.
All right. So The Day the Earth Stood Still, for starters, I just want to establish something, was the first movie to use what I call the Independence Day setup.
Yep.
Remember Independence Day, the aliens come, and then you watch the entire world react as it's coming in real time.
And they just kind of chill for a second, waiting for something to happen. Right. And what's going to happen? They're God.
You know, you go from the Pentagon to this place to that place. The Day the Earth Stood Still did that first. That's like a little side note. I think one of the greatest things about The Day the Earth Stood Still is that, have you ever seen have you ever watched The Twilight Zone?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you know how like the Twilight Zone is like all about it's really about the evils of man.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot about paranoia and the evils of man.
Right. And also McCarthyism.
McCarthyism, yeah. It's, paranoia.
Very rarely the aliens come down to Earth and actually want to kill the Earthlings in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Instead they're just exposing, you know, the worst aspects of humankind.
Yep.
Well, that's what The Day the Earth Stood Still was all about. A little plot synopsis is basically this alien comes to visit Earth. It's just this alien and his crazy alien robot, which, by the way, is literally just a dude wrapped in cardboard and tinfoil.
Yeah, it's a giant tinfoil suit.
Yeah, but the guy says basically that if Earth doesn't get its act together, this robot that he's built is going to destroy all of humankind. And it was sort of one of these movies that even in the 50s. In an era of McCarthyism although it was a paranoid culture, but it was also uptight culture.
Right.
This movie was actually pretty brave in sort of saying, you know, we're not doing a good job, especially after World War II. We were the victors, and I think America felt pretty good about itself at that time.
Right.
And
the threat of nuclear war was starting up, and the threat of... Yeah.
It was also, he was saying we were way too violent, you know, and that it was sort of like this, it was sort of like the first, like the, he was so above us that he would have no problem destroying us if we didn't get our act together, which I think has been a long thread ever since.
That's a very popular science fiction thread now.
Right. So I sort of give it to that movie first. And you know what? It still holds up. You know, it looks dated. Don't get me wrong. But I think compared to some of the really old sci-fi movies where you could literally see the string on the flying saucer as it came down.
The Trip to the Moon, like the Méliès movie.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't it? And they used...
It's on Netflix now.
Yeah, remember? And that's actually the basis behind that terrible Martin Scorsese
Hugo?
Movie.
Hugo?
Yeah. I mean, I love Ben Kingsley. Don't get me wrong. I could watch Ben Kingsley read the phone book, but it was a terrible movie.
It wasn't that great.
Actually, as far as strings on, saucers go, the Méliès, what's it, how do you say his name,
is it Méliès?
Méliès, that movie's not so bad. It's actually
A Trip
pretty,
to the Moon is cool. Yeah,
it's
very
actually
cool.
Pretty interesting to watch.
Yeah,
all right.
It is cool.
So number 8, if anyone,
oh wait, wasn't that movie remade at Day of the Earth?
It was
still with Keanu Reeves and it was,
and John Hamm,
god awful,
and John Hamm was in
John Hamm was in that,
my man John Hamm.
John Hamm is cool, but
I like John Hamm. Yeah, it was remade. I never watched it. I'm actually thinking about maybe I should see it just to see what happens.
Top 10 sci-fi remakes of everything.
All right, number 8. A lot of people hate this movie. South Park made an entire episode slamming this movie, but I think it's great. It's called Contact.
I love Contact.
All right,
it's
good.
Fantastic.
All right, so what do you like about Contact?
I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I mean, I saw it in the theater, and it was just like the sense of like unknown in that movie. Like you don't really know exactly. She's basically setting up a thing that they get this program code from the satellite, they're monitoring the satellites.
Right.
They get this code.
Right.
They don't really know what the fuck it's going to do. They spend like all of Earth's money to build a giant machine without knowing what's going to happen.
Right.
And then she jumps in a pod and then she like goes. Like, it's crazy. Like,
right. And one thing I really like about that movie, for starters, is that it also deals with the political ramifications of going into space.
Yeah.
So, like, remember they build the first ship or whatever the machine is to take her into space. And it gets blown up by, like, Christian evangelicals.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, this was at a time when Clinton was in office, really before the Christian evangelicals took over the White House, so to speak, and and really became a huge voice in, like, politics. This movie sort of foresaw their anti-science stance even then.
Yep.
It's really well acted. It really...
Jodie Foster.
Right. It really goes into the idea of spirituality and science and where do they intermingle.
Right. It does do that. Yeah, he's basically kind of like taking a leap of faith for her. Like, okay, I'm going to believe this science is right.
But more than that, I think the coolest thing the movie does is it inverts the theory of relativity. So if you remember this, right, the idea is that... So Swift, if I send you into a rocket ship, right, at near the speed of light for an hour, right, and then you come back to Earth, an hour will have passed for you. But for me, I'll be like a 90-year-old man, if not dead.
Right.
Right. So if you remember in this movie, she's in this pod. She's got these things spinning around her.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pod falls.
And it falls, yep.
And it falls directly into the water so that everybody who's watching, what they see is just the pod fall into the water and they think nothing's happened. It took about 2 seconds.
Yep.
But for her, while she's falling, she actually goes through a wormhole that takes 18 hours.
Yep.
So in fact, time slows for her while it's actually remaining the same on Earth. So it's the opposite of the theory of relativity.
Yep.
A famous science fiction writer wrote the book Contact named Carl Sagan.
Yep.
And it's basically his idea that if you go through a wormhole, it may be the opposite, that time may actually slow for you while it's actually completely normal on Earth.
Yeah.
And then when she gets out, nobody believes her about what happened. She spoke to an alien. People hated that it was her dad. I thought it made total sense that if they went through all this trouble to contact her specifically,
that they would take the form of her dad, right?
Or the form of something that would make her comfortable.
Right.
You know what I mean? They wouldn't, like, let's say they were giant insects who had the ability to transform themselves. Why would they show themselves as giant insects?
Right, if they had that ability. And that also played into the spirituality thing, too, because almost like an afterlife type scenario.
Right. And she also has to, even though she knows what happened to her, she has no proof at the time. So she has to basically trust her own faith that this thing happened and that she didn't imagine it because nobody else believes her. But one of the things I love about the movie is that a VHS tape turns out to be the piece of evidence that could prove her right, because she's recording the whole thing on VHS.
Yeah.
And they say when they play it back to her in like the hearing to expose her as a liar, which, side note, James Woods is the guy, and God bless him. If you ever need somebody to play a smarmy dude who you just hate, James Woods is so good. I mean, he's like...
Call James Woods.
I love James Woods.
He's great.
Yeah, he's a fantastic... I can make a top 10 list just on James Woods movies because there's so many good ones.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, I'm sorry to say I left Videodrome off this list.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because that is a classic James Woods sci-fi.
Right.
But anyway, so back to that tape. He's showing, he's like, oh, there's nothing but static on this tape. But it turns out the static is 18 hours of it. And if you know, if you haven't recorded anything on a tape, it won't have static.
No,
it just won't play.
It just won't play.
It'll just be black.
Yeah.
But there's 18 hours of static on that tape, which I love. Contact, great movie. The guys at South Park hated it. But I think it actually holds up really well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they hate everything. I'm sensing a theme here, though, that it's another movie that's, like, based in the real world. And, you know, how the real world is reacting to science and science fiction instead of being a, like, created universe world.
Right. I just want to let the audience know my wife walked in. Very silently.
Very silent. Very ninja-like.
She was looking for the phone charger that I took from her.
Oops.
And then she stays out while we're doing this nerd stuff. All right. So next movie, number 7, the only movie from this franchise I put on this list, Wrath of Khan.
Nice.
Star Trek 2.
It's the best one. Probably.
It's easily the best one. Yeah. And if I had to, I'll define my love for it in two words, and then Swift, I'll let you talk about this. Space gypsies.
Yep. Space gypsies. They were
space gypsies. Yeah. Ricardo Montalban and his crew were space gypsies.
They were space gypsies.
And I love it. I never really got the whole, like, he's a superhuman thing.
Well, I mean, basically, that movie, the Star Trek, the original Star Trek series.
There is a puppet series, though, and an animated series.
The original Star Trek series came on in the 60s, and there was, like, you know, every episode was pretty much episodic.
Yeah.
One episode, they find a ship floating in space, and then there's this guy, and it's Khan, and he's like, oh, they find out he's, like, a race of superhumans from whatever century, and they put them in frozen cryogenic stasis because they were, like, fucking up the Earth. So they put him in there, and they find him. And then at the end of that episode, when basically they try to take, he took over the Enterprise, they, like, capture, you know, take it back, like, like, exile him to a planet.
Right.
And so, like, basically, whatever, 20 years later, however long, maybe 15, they bring him back in this movie, like, out of the blue. So that, you know, that's, they don't really explain in the movie, like,
right, no, they don't. Thing. You would have had to see, and by the way, if you've ever seen, I've never seen the episode, I'm not a huge Star Trek guy, I've never seen the episode where Khan originally appeared, but he looks, if you take a screenshot of him, if you search him on the internet, he looks totally different.
Totally
in that
different.
Star Trek. He's, like, got black hair. I think he's meant, Khan was a Mongolian, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is
he
funny.
He was supposed to be a Mongolian.
Because Ricardo Montalban is, like, Spanish or Cuban or something. He's not even close to Mongolian.
No.
But in the episode, they try to make him look Mongolian. Because I think he was, like, a warlord on Earth or something. Like, I think he was supposed to be one of the Khans.
He was supposed to be, like, a Khan, and, like, he was, like, a warlord and taking over the world.
Right, so they give him this really terrible, like, black hair to, like, make him look more, like, Asian. But the movie's freaking awesome. I mean, in a weird way, it's like, it doesn't really translate to a lot of the other Star Wars stuff, but it's like Star Trek. Sorry, God, that's how much you see. I'm a Star Wars guy, but it's like a standalone. It just works so well. It's such a good tale, and there's a lot of heart there, which sometimes I think Star Trek was lacking.
Yeah, I mean, the original Star Trek series, like you were talking about earlier, is very cold. It's very, like...
Well, it's really... I always think of it as hippies in space.
Yeah, it's sort of hippie-ish. But there's definitely that, like, 60s paranoia and cold, isolated feeling to the show. Right. The movies are very different in tone than the show was.
I think of the show sort of as the more idealistic version of the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Twilight Zone was very cynical about people, and I think the show was more about, like, humans at their best.
That's basically what Gene Roddenberry wanted to create. Like, all races, all in harmony, and, like, except for the Zalian races, then these guys are all jerks.
They were an enterprise that was supposed to go around and make contact with other civilizations, not kill them. In fact, I think that's the worst thing about the movies, is all they do is fight.
It's all fighting, no exploration in the movies.
Yeah, I mean, Star Trek, they're supposed to meet cool aliens and say, like, hey, what's up, want some corn?
And then make out with them, because they're green hot ladies.
It's supposed to basically make up for what the settlers did the American Indians. We're supposed to be giving back, like, going out throughout the universe trying to make up for the horrendous crime of our colonization of America.
Yep, that's true, actually.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
That's a good point.
All right, by the way, I got to get this out of the way now when it comes to Star Trek versus Star Wars. I love Star Wars. I did not include Star Wars on this list.
Any Star Wars? Anything?
Not a single Star Wars. Not even Empire. And I'm going to explain why. First of all, we will have Star Wars themed episodes of this podcast.
Yeah.
But I do not think of Star Wars as science fiction. I don't think it has anything to say about today. The closest it gets to anything really is religion, if anything.
Right.
I think of it as space fantasy.
It's space fantasy. It's right. It's not...
It's space adventure. It's not...
Yeah.
There's nothing science-y in Star Wars. I mean... Other than, you know, the Force is, like, more mystical than anything. And I love Star Wars, but...
They tried to make it science-y, but that was stupid.
I wanted to make sure I included the science in the fiction.
Right.
You know?
All
right.
But yeah, Star Trek 2 is awesome. It is cheesy, but it's lovably cheesy, and it's just, like...
If anything, it's maybe the least cheesy.
It's the least cheesy. It still is the least cheesy.
Right.
And there's some just, like, the part where he puts the thing in the guy's ear.
Yeah, that is always the part that sticks with me.
And then what? Okay, so let's get into this a little bit. They sort of remade this movie when they made Star Trek 2.
Yeah, I mean, all right.
Sort of.
Here's all
I have to, kind of badly, but I still kind of like that movie a little bit.
the thing about all J.J. Abrams movies is that, like, they seem really cool, and then when you think about them later, you're like, oh, that didn't make sense. And here's what I will say about Star Trek movies by J.J. Abrams. The first scene of the first movie is the best part of both movies.
Yeah, that first scene is incredible.
And they're all downhill from there. And if I really have, I could get a whole rant about how J.J. Abrams, the first three quarters of all his movies are great, and then the endings, they just fall apart. Like, Super 8, right, that movie, they literally wish the alien to go away.
Yeah,
like,
that was a...
They're like, get out of here, man! Or Mission Impossible 3, which had an awesome first three quarters. The end just, like, devolves into nonsense.
Yeah.
And in Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, or not The Wrath of Khan, whatever the second Star Trek
it's
movie.
It's just called Into Darkness, that's what it's called.
Once Khan actually reveals who he is, he literally just reveals it in a 10-minute monologue in a cell because they totally forgot to explain who he was, ran out of budget, and were like, oh, just you act the hell out of this, Benedict Cumberbatch. And they didn't have any flashbacks or anything. I mean, it was so lame how they did it.
That is what you're... The one thing I learned, like, don't do this in movies. Don't explain plot through dialogue.
Right, yeah. The only cool thing about that movie was when they finally showed us some Klingons.
Yeah, that was cool.
Hopefully, if they even make a third movie... Oh. You know that movie's a disappointment financially. They didn't make the type of money they thought they'd make.
Right, which they still made money, but they have ideas in their head of how much it should make.
All
right,
so let's move on. Number six, and this is the only kind of movie that I included on this list, Brazil, which is a comedy. Have you seen Brazil?
No.
All right.
You need to I know see what Brazil. It is.
All right. It's Terry Gilliam, yeah. Right? One of the guys from Monty Python.
It's a comedy?
Yeah. It's a comedy about what happens if a bureaucracy, basically, forget a tyrannical bureaucracy, but just imagine the worst inefficient bureaucracy ever becomes tyrannical, right? So the sort of the opposite of the Nazis, because the Nazis were also extremely efficient in their tyranny, right?
Right.
But imagine the Nazis couldn't do anything without like 10 miles of paperwork.
That's pretty funny.
Right. This is what Brazil is about. Brazil is about a dystopian future where the government that controls them is just completely inept and there's nothing but red tape everywhere. And it's very much about modern-day government, modern-day bureaucracies, and how they drive people insane.
Right.
The movie definitely has the look of the Monty Python movies. I mean, the set pieces are just amazing. There's, like, no CGI. But if you were to walk into one of these sets, you would just be amazed by how they look. It's got an awesome cast. It's got Robert De Niro playing a crazy dude. Terry Gilliam's masterpiece. And it follows the standard trope of sci-fi, which is it takes something in the future and it's about today.
Right.
Right.
It's an allegory for today.
But the thing it chooses, I almost feel like Terry Gilliam had a really bad experience at the DMV, right, or whatever you guys call your MVA, your Department of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah.
Waited in line too long, finally got up there and had a woman tell him his paperwork was incorrect and he'd have to come back next week, which I think is what we all have. Yeah. We've all had an experience at the DMV at least once after you get your driver's license. And this is like, imagine the DMV ran the universe. And that's what Brazil is all about.
That's a scary thought.
It's a terrifying thought.
I can't think of anything worse than that.
And another thing is, the movie has a really famous production story about how Terry Gilliam really fought with the studio over the ending of the movie. And his original ending that he preferred was way darker than the ending that actually came out in theaters. I mean, literally the opposite. Imagine life and death, basically.
Right.
And when it came out in theaters, I mean, they locked him out of the editing room. There are famous stories of him literally stealing the reels of film and them stealing them back and him locking out, you know, production people from the editing room. I mean, it's a wild story of a guy fighting a big studio. And then, of course, what always happens with these things is eventually someone unearths the original ending, puts it together, and now everyone's like, oh, that's so much better.
Right.
So
director's cut.
Yeah. Brazil, great movie. Now, number five. This may be in some ways my favorite movie on this list, but I'm doing this in terms of what's the best. Dark City,
yeah.
Have you seen Dark City?
Yeah. Dude, it's been a while.
Dude, Dark City is unbelievable.
Aronofsky, right?
No, it's not. No, it's not Aronofsky.
I always get this
Dark
confused.
City is the movie about this guy. He wakes up like in the middle of the night. He has no memory and he's going around and everybody in the city is asleep. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And there are these crazy bald dudes, like these creepy or horrible bald dudes who are running these experiments on all the people that are asleep at night. And he's the only person who's awake. In a lot of ways, The Matrix, which took from so many things, also took from Dark City.
Yeah, like it's the idea, dark look.
Yeah, it's the idea that basically, I mean, it has a surprise ending, and I don't want to give too much away, but obviously the humans, and it's very much, it's built like 1930s New York City is the city that they're in.
Yeah.
And all I'm going to say is it's not necessarily 1930s New York City, but that's what the place that these humans exist are led to believe it is.
Yeah.
It's a crazy dark movie. It's like a sci-fi and a detective noir at the same time.
It's got that noir, yeah.
So style-wise, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I can't remember the actor from the movie. His name's like Rupert something, or he's an English guy. He pops up every now and then. It's a fantastic movie. If no one's ever seen Dark City, it's really like a... It's a cult classic.
Yeah, it's like a science fiction film noir.
Right. And there's a lot of movies like that. Roger Ebert called it his favorite movie of the year. And when he did top 10 movies of the 90s, he listed Dark City as one of them.
Really?
Yeah. So interesting. Apparently, Roger Ebert.
Oh, Alex Proyas directed it. Okay, that's right.
What did Proyas do?
The Crow and iRobot.
He did The Crow. So, yeah, The Crow. And there's definitely a lot of the style. Yeah. From The Crow in there. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So there is that. But Dark City, number 5, awesome movie. Which leads us to number 4, a movie I don't like as much, but I just cannot deny its cultural relevancy, which is The Matrix.
The Matrix, yep.
What to say about
The
Matrix?
I mean, it was like a seminal
work
for people our age, I think.
It was.
I was in this was like my senior year of high school, and I remember, I think Phantom Menace was coming out that year, next year. Yeah, very close together.
Right around then.
So I remember seeing The Matrix, and it was amazing, and then being like, oh man, I hope Star Wars is this good, and it turns out, nope. But I think one of the...
Star Wars had it... Yeah. Phantom Menace of the 3, by the way, is the best one.
It is.
Okay, sorry.
I think one of the best things about The Matrix was how they marketed it, because no one really had any idea what it was.
That's what I wanted to touch on. That was the reason, and I know I'm going to sound like a total noob, but I didn't see it in theaters.
Oh.
I had no interest because I didn't know what the movie was about, and I thought it was just some crappy action movie. Like, I'm not really into action.
Right.
I'm not into guns I'm not into gunfighting or any of that other stuff. So I thought it was going to be a movie that was going to be utterly uninteresting. And then one day I was at a friend's house. He popped in the VHS tape of The Matrix, and my mind was blown.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God. That's an unbelievably great movie. Like, I literally had no idea it was that hardcore of a sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
I had no idea whatsoever. So when I saw it, I was so blown away. And the thing about that movie is you really care. Like, when the bad guy, Joe Pantoliano, the bald guy, when he does what he does, right, it's a genuinely traumatic scene.
It is. That's
everything about that movie, you really care all the way until the end. My problem with that movie is they made sequels.
Yeah, the sequels are not good.
Well, it's not even... The sequels could have been great, but the problem was at the end of The Matrix, he can see the code.
Right.
Right? He is God within The Matrix.
Right.
He even says, I'm here to free you all or something like that. And then you see The Matrix on this giant error symbol. Right? Mm-hmm. It's over.
The story is pretty much over.
The story's done. That's how they made it. And then in the second movie, they take his powers and reduce it to, oh, he can fly.
Right.
You know what I mean? Which is absurd.
I hate when they do stuff like that in movies. They have to have a reason for the next movie him not to be so powerful that it breaks the movie.
Yeah.
So they have to, reduce it. And I really hate that in storytelling.
Yeah, it's just, it's just such an obvious, writer's trope so they could make more money. It's utter garbage. It's nonsense.
It is. And the problem with the sequels is really, a lot of the CGI is really bad.
Oh, God.
It's...
Dude, number 2, you remember the New York-Brooklyn courtyard fight?
Yes.
With the multiple Agent Smiths?
When I saw that in theaters, I was just disgusted. I thought it was the worst thing I've ever seen. It was so bad. CGI was so obvious.
It literally looks like a Sony PlayStation 1 Final Fantasy cutscene.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not as impressive.
Right. It's bad.
The second that they all start going up in the air and fighting, there's absolutely no skin detail on anybody.
Right.
They're just slick, like characters that have no like marks on their skin whatsoever, no moles, no nothing.
It's bad.
Although I do like to stay up at night and try to figure out what the architect was saying.
What the hell was he talking about?
Probably he was talking about nothing, but I really like to think that somewhere within there is an answer, and that one of these days I'll have an epiphany and it'll hit me. Like, one day I had an epiphany as to what the Backstreet Boys song "I Want It That Way" was actually about.
Oh no.
I'm not going to tell you now because that'll be for another day.
It's not the time or place.
Where I will reveal that. And by the way, when I do reveal that, you will, anyone who listens to this will be immortal.
Right.
You will gain immortality.
Immortality.
But yeah, Matrix 2 sucked, but I do want to talk about the Matrix 3 for a second.
Yeah.
I love the Matrix 3, but
I kind of like the Matrix 3 too.
Not because it's a good movie, but because it's like, what if like, the Matrix 2 tried to be super cutting edge. It tried to out-Matrix the Matrix.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It was basically kind of the same movie again with
They just tried to make it so much harder sci-fi.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work.
No, it didn't work.
The thing I love about The Matrix 3 is like, the producer's like, all right, you know what? We're taking this movie now. And it is such a Hollywood movie. It is such a Hollywood epic that I just cannot help but love it. Because it's so full of cliches and things that Hollywood knows are tried and true to work.
Yep.
And it just plays up to all of them. Like, when the best part of that movie is when they're in the Mech Warriors.
Yeah, dude.
And that guy gives that speech, and then you watch the Sentinels, or whatever. What are they called?
They're called Sentinels.
They're called Sentinels, and they're coming out of like the ceiling of Zion.
Yeah,
it's so cool, and it's painted. It looks a lot like how Lord of the Rings used their own CGI.
Yeah,
which they didn't try to make things look real. They tried to make things look painted.
Right.
To give it a storybook quality.
Yeah.
And that's actually what the Matrix 3 did.
They gave it an artistic quality instead of just trying to make it look real.
And I love that the Matrix 3 had no qualms about Christ references
or
anything else. Like, that movie had no qualms with being over the top. And I loved it for it. I mean, it's a bad movie, no doubt. But it is way more enjoyable than The Matrix 2.
It definitely is. I agree with that completely. I mean, Hugo Weaving, man.
Which one had the orgy?
That was the second one,
I think. That was the second one?
I think so. Well, it was when they first got to Zion, I think.
Yeah. The orgy was pretty cool. I dug that.
Yeah.
The third one also had Jada Pinkett Smith, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome, dude. Morpheus, they took a character who was so cool in the first movie and made him like a religious zealot. In the second and third.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, in the first movie, he's just like this guy who you trust. And in the second and third movie, he's like the high priest of nonsense.
The high priest of bullshit.
Yeah. Like, no one even takes him seriously, like, within Zion. Anyways, The Matrix, a seminal movie, changed everything. Side note, we've mentioned this before in top 10 cartridge video games, but if you ever want to play a game where it really feels like bullet time, play Conker's Bad Fur Day.
Yeah, Conker's Bad Fur Day. Because
the last level is the Matrix, and they actually did bullet time better than anyone else has ever done it, including Max Payne. All right, number three. I don't know if any of you guys have seen this movie, but it's super low budget, and I believe it won like the top award at Cannes, and it's a sci-fi. It's called Primer.
Are you talking about Primer? Yeah.
Have you seen Primer?
I've seen part of it.
All right, so Primer is a super low budget movie about two guys, scientists, who make a time machine. And let me ask you a question. Like, if you had a time machine, what would you use it for?
What would I use it for?
Like, legitimately, what would you use your time machine for?
Well, I sort of want to go back and see, like, ancient Rome.
Okay, so that's cool. Wouldn't you rather just find out what the numbers to the lottery were?
I mean, I would do that, too.
Right. So that's what these guys do. These two scientists build a time machine. They literally store it in, like, in a public storage locker type deal, you know, like one of those crates basically that you could live in, you could put a bed in.
Yeah, oh, right, like that. Right. Okay, right.
They put it in there, they go in there, and they literally will use this time machine to go like 2 days back and just start investing in stocks and things that they know are going to like blow up.
Gray Sports Almanac.
Right, exactly. That's a Back to the Future 2 reference for all you noobs who didn't know that. And they just, you know, they play the stocks and they play the lottery. They do little things, basically, that will enhance their pocketbook. But what happens is one of the guys starts going back without the knowledge of the other guy, and then they start to get really confused as to what time they're actually in, right? It's a puzzle. You really have to, like, I still have not completely figured it out. But the idea is they keep going back, and at a certain point, you, the viewer, and the characters start getting confused as if whether or not they're actually in the present. Really? And if the person they're talking to, imagine, Swift, if you and I built this time machine, we set rules. We go back together and we come back together, right?
Yeah.
And then imagine all of a sudden you break that rule and you go back without me one time. Ooh. And then you come back and then I find out and I do the same thing. And then we actually are never sure if we're in the true present.
Right.
Or if the person we're talking to is the one from the present.
Right.
So it becomes super confusing. And it's really like trying to solve a mathematical problem in this movie. Once again, a lot like Ex Machina, where great writing and a tiny bit of money can go a long, long way. I mean, you don't even really see the machine. They just step into this public storage locker.
And then they're...
And then you would have no idea that it was the same day, if not for the fact that they've told you. And like half the time, they're just at the library or like at the bank or like the stock market, like doing this stuff. But it's absolutely wild, like... The ramifications, like, they start having nosebleeds. One of them forgets, like, starts unlearning how to read. Huh. Like, these are, like, supposed, like, the medical, like, effects of, like, going back in time.
Right.
It's super cool because they try to take time travel at a realistic, like, vantage point.
Yeah. Wasn't one of those guys, like, an actual scientist or something? And then he...
He might have been. I think the writer-director actually had a background in science.
Yeah.
And decided to make this movie. Right. It's totally amateur acting, amateur filmmaking. It's like, really, if you and your buddies made a movie and you just nailed it, right? But you made it with, like, your video cameras and, like, your friends, you know... And you just happen to nail it. It's sort of like if you made the Blair Witch Project. And, you know, I was going to say only that it was good. But I actually think the Blair Witch Project is good.
It's good.
Yeah, you know what? It scared me. And it scared me too. I don't think I've ever watched it since. And
I didn't know at first that it was fake. But
what?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, my God.
I was a little bit younger.
You're so sweet.
I know. But that was real.
You're so innocent. That's unbelievable that you thought that was real. I don't know if I respect you more or a lot more or a lot less. It's definitely one or the other. All right. So now, that was number three, Primer. I know that's really high up on the list, but the reason I made it so high is I wanted to show that, like, sci-fi is about a concept.
It's about ideas.
It's about ideas.
Good sci-fi is about ideas.
It does not need to have a budget at all.
Right.
All right.
I agree.
So there's two left. I want to see if you can guess number two. I feel like everybody knows from what I've left out that the one and the two have to be a specific thing, and it just becomes what is number two and what is number one.
I don't know. There's so many options.
Think about the two most famous.
Two most famous science fiction movies?
Ever. Especially in America.
2001 A Space Odyssey?
So that's not number two. Number two is Blade Runner.
Right.
All right. So Blade Runner. First of all, a future where Chinatown is everywhere, terrifying.
Yeah.
I don't like going to Chinatown now. No disrespect to the Chinese.
I love Chinatown.
I just have no idea what's going on. I'm like, wait a minute. What's happening here? Like, why are you, like, stuffing a live octopus in my face? Like, get this sea creature away from me. Like, I don't want anything killed at my table.
Right.
But Blade Runner is really cool because it takes the whole... Well, for starters, I just want to say one thing about Blade Runner. If not for Rucker Hauer's performance, this movie might not even be on the list.
Right.
Right. Rucker Hauer's performance, I think even Ridley Scott, the director, said about it. He's like, I really had no idea he was going to do that. And the idea basically of, you don't have to be sentient to think you're sentient.
Right.
Right. Like, you don't actually have to be real to have the desire to live. If I build a robot and program it to have a desire to live, then isn't that simulated feeling just as strong as the real thing?
That's the question, isn't it?
Right. So I believe that it is. I think what's cool about Blade Runner is I'm not a film historian, but it might have been, and also Ridley Scott's sort of the guy who can be responsible for both of this, is sort of the first movie to take sci-fi and strip away the clean look.
Yeah.
Right?
It's very dirty.
It's
gritty.
Very dirty. And I think it looks at the idea of a city, right? And if you look at sci-fi movies where an entire planet's a city, like Coruscant from Star Wars.
Right.
Oh, it's so clean and everything's so shiny.
Ugh.
And this movie takes the opposite. It's like, a city would be nothing but filth, especially if a planet was nothing but a city.
Yeah, it would be disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cool thing about Blade Runner is it has all the elements of everything in sci-fi. mm-hmm. space, robots, the Chinese.
Laser weapons.
The noir aspect to it.
It's a film noir is what it really is.
The philosophical aspect. It's a detective story. It is a detective story. It also has the production elements that a lot of other sci-fi movies have had, where Ridley Scott had a hard time with the producers, and the movie was originally released with this terrible voiceover by Harrison Ford to sort of explain what was going on. In fact, a lot of people who have seen the movie, like, not in theaters would never know that, because most of the cuts of it now don't have that narration. It's also a movie famous for having multiple cuts.
There's lots of cuts of the movie.
Yeah, there's not like the theater cut and the director's cut. There's actually multiple cuts of this movie.
Yeah.
I want to talk about this right now. Is he a robot?
I don't know.
I'll say this. I never even had any inkling that he was a robot until I read about the movie online after I saw it.
Yeah.
Like, there was nothing in... And I'd love for someone to walk
up... Oh, you mean Deckard? Yeah.
I would love for someone to walk up to me and say to me, no, here's in the movie where it's quite possible that Harrison Ford is also a robot.
I didn't see it either when I didn't think about that either when I saw it.
One thing I love about the movie, too, is, like, Rucker Hauer's speech when he's dying, when he's, like, deactivating.
Yeah.
It's like he's infused with the spirit of Edgar Allan Poe. It's, like, so eloquent, like, what he says and how he does it. The movie's fantastic. It's also, I decided not to put Alien on this movie.
On this list, right.
On this list, because, as far as I'm concerned, Alien is not a science fiction movie. It's a horror film.
It is definitely a horror film.
It's a monster movie, right? The alien's a monster. What's it?
It is a horror. Yeah,
it's part of the reason I left The Thing off of this movie, because why is a monster film like Frankenstein or, you know, any werewolf movie, right? Why are those horror films? And if the monster is an alien, why is it a science fiction film? Especially if the majority of the elements of the movie are meant to terrify you,
right?
You see what I mean, like. I don't see anything in Alien that is about the present day.
You're looking at it as if science fiction is like the genre instead of, and I guess it kind of is.
I'm looking at it like with a very narrow lens.
Yes.
Right. I'm looking at it with like the idea that it has to be saying something about the present day.
Right.
Right. That is the lens I'm looking at.
Yeah, you're not looking at if it as like the dressing, right. Like the spaceships and stuff and all that.
Right. All right. I want to give a couple bonus awards here.
But Alien is fantastic.
Yeah, Alien's a great movie, but I think of it as a horror film.
It is definitely a horror film.
By the way, side note about Alien. If you've ever seen the director's cut, they left out a scene where the ship's captain had been like colonized. By the alien, right? Like, he's, like, up in, mm-hmm. like, the ceiling, and he's, like, covered in, like, plasma. Like, she's, like, the alien's turning him into an alien, basically. Right. And then he asks
Ripley
to burn him alive, and she does. I never knew why they didn't include that scene.
I don't know if I've seen the director's cut or not.
That scene is so awesome. I have no idea why they didn't include it. All right, so here are my bonus awards. One. In some ways, I wanted to include this movie on the list. Science fiction movie for kids that works. John Carter.
John Carter of Mars.
Yeah, so the original title of the movie was John Carter from Mars, but then they actually changed it to John Carter, which is a shame.
Yeah, it's a stupid name.
I saw that movie, and I gotta tell you, on my Facebook, the only way I could think to review it was like, all I have to say about John Carter from Mars is a 12-year-old me would have gone apeshit for this movie, and sometimes that's enough.
Yeah.
Like, if I was 12 years old, right. I would have freaking loved that movie.
Yeah.
And any 12-year-old who does love that movie has nothing to be ashamed about. That movie is so freaking fun.
I love movies that make you feel like that, and it's hard to find.
I really felt nostalgic when I watched that movie. I was like, you know what? This movie's doing everything right for a kid, and it's really a shame it didn't do better business, because it's a whole series. Bad. It's a whole series of famous science fiction books. And the premise is amazing. A Confederate soldier in the Civil War gets transported to another planet. That is unbelievable. And he has, like, superpowers on that planet.
Yeah.
That is so freaking cool.
It's like Captain America.
Yeah, it is. Captain Confederate. And he's on another, like... If I had to give a bonus award for science fiction movies for kids, that would be it. Side note. Dune is my favorite book of all time.
Great book.
It is the Lord of the Rings of sci-fi.
Yes,
it is the gold standard to which all sci-fi must be held.
And
but it just has not been done right.
Never.
And I cannot include any Dune adaptation on this list.
I'm not sure it can be done right.
I will say this. If I ever meet Peter Jackson, the only thing I'll say to him is, you are the only man on this planet who can make Dune.
Yeah.
That is true. I would love to meet Peter Jackson and just say to him, if you want to really, like, first of all, he has cemented his legendary status for Lord of the Rings. He never has to do anything else to be a legend in my mind.
Yeah.
But if he wants to be an immortal, one with the gods, if he makes Dune well, then he is just, like, the greatest, I don't know, like, large-scale filmmaker of all time.
Yeah.
I feel like he can do it.
Oh, I don't know, man. Like, I wonder who has the rights to that now.
I mean, it seems like everybody does because it's already been made by the Science Fiction Channel,
which doesn't have
that much money.
It's a long time ago now, though.
Not a good adaptation. It's a miniseries, but I will say this. They did a decent job with their second adaptation of Dune miniseries called Children of Dune, which is an adaptation of the second and third books of the Dune series, Dune Messiah and Children of Dune.
Yeah.
They did a decent job with that, and I just want to recommend, if nobody's ever read the Dune series, if you want to read only one of them, that's fine. Dune on its own is unbelievable.
Amazing book.
But it is well worth it to read all six. I think it's six. Yeah, all six. It may even be seven.
I think it was seven.
I think it's seven. Yeah, it is well worth it.
I think it's his son finished the seventh
no,
one.
No. Forget his son. It's Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, Emperor of Dune, Chapter House Dune, Heretics of Dune. I think that's it. I think there's only six.
Okay.
His son did complete one with a writer named Kevin Anderson, who's a complete hack.
Yeah.
But I don't count.
Well, they've written like 1,000 now, which is nuts.
I don't count anything written by his son and Kevin Anderson, who is the worst science fiction writer of all time. If you ever see a really cool looking book with an awesome cover and then it says written by Kevin Anderson, just turn your back.
Burn it.
Turn away. Yeah. Well, don't. No. We don't advocate book burning on this podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I was somewhere else for a second.
No, don't burn it. All right. Dune, please. I couldn't do a science fiction podcast without mentioning Dune. Is there anything you want to mention before we get to number one?
Well, if you want to find out more about kind of the history of Dune filmmaking, you should watch this documentary called Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yes, I love it.
Which was amazing. He's this Mexican director who made some really weird films in the 70s, tried to make Dune. He basically created the entire movie in an amazing storybook.
Yeah.
Storyboarded it out. Yeah. He was trying to hire like Salvador Dali and like all these crazy people to be
Orson
Welles. It looked insane and not actually super close to the book really, but just crazy. But it's a great documentary
It's a fantastic documentary on failed grand aspirations. It sort of goes along with the movie The Man from La Mancha.
Yeah.
Which was about Terry Gilliam, a name already popped up on this list, trying to do Don Quixote and failing miserably, and it just doesn't work out. The other thing is, one of my absolute life goals is to get my hands on one of the Dune production books.
Yeah,
the one that he made. That would make my world.
That would be awesome.
If I became like a millionaire, that would be the first thing I look for. Like the first thing I'd hire a personal assistant just to look for that.
Find this book. I think there's only like two.
And pay any price. Yeah, it would be unbelievable.
Yeah, man.
Are there any other things you want to touch on before we get to number
one? I mean, there's tons of good
yes, there's a lot of good sci-fi.
There's a lot of good ones.
Well, no, actually, I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of bad sci-fi.
I guess there's more bad than good when it comes to anything.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's true.
But were there any movies you thought maybe I should have kept on this list?
Well, you're looking at it from a very narrow, specific set.
But you just go nuts.
Like 12 Monkeys, another Terry Gilliam film, is great.
I decided not to include 12 Monkeys because I think that movie's stupid.
It is dumb, but it's...
I can't explain it. Yeah. I don't know. Like, people love that movie. Like, oh my God, 12 Monkeys, so great. Don't you love 12 Monkeys? I'm like, meh. I don't know. Meh. Like, I'm not hating on it. Like, I don't know. Maybe it is good and I just don't like it. But something about that movie rubs me the wrong way.
I can understand that.
I also want to say about Ex Machina number 10, the first movie that was number 10 that I had on this list was Event Horizon.
Oh, yeah, dude.
And I just couldn't think of any good reason to keep it on
the list. It's a horror film, too, actually.
It is a horror film.
Yeah.
I love it. I'm not even sure it's a good movie. I couldn't find any justification other than the fact I love it to keep it on the list.
Yeah.
Like, if I love it means it should be on the list, then Independence Day would be number one. And yeah. Starship Troopers would also be on the list.
Right.
But I tried to keep it to movies that I think are quality.
Yeah.
Like, not just...
that are high art.
One of the number one things I have a problem with people with is if they like something, they think it's good.
Right.
And you've got to be able to be just objective enough to say, you know what? I like something that's not good. And right. that doesn't make me dumb.
Yep.
Like, I can't stand the idea that if you like it, it's good. Like, when we look at art, paintings, right? We go around, and if someone tells me that the Mona Lisa is good and they're an art professor or an art historian, I believe them. They know more than me about art.
Yeah. Right?
The problem with movies is that they're so accessible and so many people watch them is that everybody thinks they're entitled to their opinion. And the fact is they're not. Like, if you talk to a film historian and you're only into Bruce Willis action movies
right.
and you think that your opinion is valid as theirs, guess what, buddy? It's not.
Well, right, because they have obviously seen a lot more right. films than you.
Like, just like painting and sculpture and everything else, there's a craft to filmmaking.
Yeah.
And once you've seen enough, you will start to learn what is better than what.
Right.
Anyways, that was a little side rant.
Well,
I feel strongly about that.
Yeah, I was going to say that art is different because it's less complicated, but
no,
I don't think that's true.
Think so.
But movie, I mean, you can appreciate movies on lots of different levels. You can appreciate
it's a visual art, and there's a craft to it.
Appreciate the story. It can be a terrible visual art
right.
and still have good acting or good storytelling,
sure.
or both, and still be not visually impressive, or a lot of times visually impressive but really bad story and acting wise.
All right, let's get to number one. Super obvious, 2001.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
What?
It's like the science fiction movie.
Yeah, it is the science fiction movie. 2001 is really, first of all, as much as I love the movie, I think that if you had seen it in theaters in 1969, which I believe is when it came out.
Sounds right.
It would have blown your mind. You would have never seen a science fiction movie that was as artistic.
Right.
That relied so much on sensation and feeling and vague philosophy.
Yep.
Oh,
I love vague philosophy.
Right. Here's what I want to do about 2001, right? Because we could beat it with a, you know, beat it like a dead horse and talk about all the things about 2001 that make it great. I am instead going to attempt to actually tell you what the story of 2001 is. And here's how I'm going to tell you, right? I have read the 2001 novel series written by Arthur C. Clarke.
Mm-hmm.
So he originally wrote 2001 not as a book, but as a movie with Stanley Kubrick. And then he
yeah.
turned it into a book.
That's right.
And a series of books. And instead of just talking about this movie, I want to just give you a straight up plot synopsis for anyone who's ever curious, what is it about, right? There is a species of aliens, and they exist somewhere near Jupiter. And they have buried deep in the earth these things called monoliths. And the monoliths, which are these just big black stones, are basically their Swiss Army knives, right? And
yep.
imagine these aliens are kind of like Marvel's The Watchers, right?
Yeah.
They're not like bugs or anything. They're like highly intelligent beings, right?
Yeah.
And these monoliths basically do whatever they want them to do. So at first, the monolith evolves the primordial ape, or whatever you call that, you know, our ancestors,
yeah,
into some sort of more intelligent being.
Right.
Then the human beings discover it again on the moon. And why the moon? Because when they get to the moon and they discover it, this lets the aliens know that the human race has gone to a certain intellect now,
right?
Yep. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So when they discover it, the monolith sends a signal that the humans track, which they send the crew on, including Hal, which is its own story, which has been touched on many times in this podcast, which is the idea of if something thinks it's sentient, then it is.
It is sentient.
Right.
Right.
So it goes to Jupiter, and basically these beings, these watchers, so to speak, they evolve the main astronaut. They evolve him into this creature that lacks any human form, right? It is
yep.
pure consciousness floating in space, or otherwise known as the space baby, because he's reborn
yeah.
as a consciousness. There's a really great interview with Stanley Kubrick by Playboy. There's a great book, actually, called Playboy, the Directors. And they interview Stanley Kubrick and the Coen brothers and Francis Ford Coppola and all these great, great interviews with directors. And he basically explains how he thinks that higher level consciousness probably doesn't need a physical body, right?
Right.
Like something could evolve enough. And that's basically what the space baby was. But here's the difference between the movie and the book. At the end of the book, the space baby detonates every nuclear bomb on Earth. He kills off the human race.
And in the first book?
In the first book.
Wow.
Right. But then what's... And it's the idea...
I should read more.
It's the idea of evolution, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, he gets rid of the old species, which is very much what a new species would do. But then the second book is actually a direct sequel to the movie, right? So in the second book, it's kind of like The Lost World, right? At the end of Jurassic Park, the book, yeah. Dr. Malcolm dies,
yeah,
right? But then he's the main character of the second book, The Lost World,
right?
Because that book is a sequel to the movie.
A sequel to the movie.
So 2010 is a sequel to 2001, the film. And in 2010, what you actually find out is that there's this ice planet near Jupiter. It's actually one of the moons of Jupiter. It's called Europa.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And in fact, there's a movie recently about Europa that yeah. really steals a lot from 2010.
Yeah.
And on this planet is are like these creatures. They're almost like slimy black whales. And it's an ice planet, so to speak. It's not pure, it's not actual ice, but it's some sort of cold matter.
Right.
And basically, once again, a team of scientists goes to the planet. They go missing. And then what happens is these watchers, these same aliens who evolved the humans, right? They basically send all their monoliths down to this planet of Europa, and the monoliths turn it into a giant flaming sun. And what that in fact does is it gets rid of like the cold like material on the planet of Europa, and these species once again evolve because now they have a warmer climate.
Right.
So it's really all about basically like these aliens that you never see evolving different species.
They're playing God, basically.
They're playing God. It's super cool. Let's get back to the movie.
I mean, the movie, just the beginning sequence is amazing. Like, yeah. like, it starts off with, like, these ape creatures, and they're all, you know, they're fighting and yeah. doing their ape things, and then at the end, he throws the bone in the air, and it becomes the spaceship. Like, right. we see the monolith.
What's awesome is, like, you know, Stanley Kubrick is a perfectionist.
Yes.
And just, that movie is so clearly, like, the work of a man so in command of his talents and so confident. Something I love about Stanley Kubrick and the old Hollywood system, which doesn't exist now.
It doesn't at all.
Is that when Stanley Kubrick first came out, right? Hollywood immediately recognized him as a genius. And Warner Brothers said, okay, you know what, Stanley Kubrick? We're going to offer you a contract that you will make all your movies with Warner Brothers. We will not interfere with you whatsoever.
Yeah.
We will only be your patron, right? You will be our Michelangelo, and we will be the Medici to you. And your movies will be our prestige films. We want to say, we will be proud to be the studio that made Stanley Kubrick films. And that just doesn't work anymore.
Mm-mm.
They just, you cannot walk into a studio and say, hey, I want to make you a classic film that's going to make no money.
Right.
That
doesn't work because they care only about money, because now all the studios are mega conglomerates.
Right. And, you know, 2001, once again, you know, a movie by a genius, made with no studio interference, hated by most critics, then beloved later on. The movie touches on your physical sensations, your audible sensations, your visual sensations. It touches on philosophic themes. It has its own plot. Like, it's very central plot, especially with Hal, you know, the robot. Like, that's sort of it's almost in a weird way the only thing that keeps the movie grounded.
Yeah.
You know, something where you say, oh, well, it was about this.
Right.
Otherwise, it may not be about anything.
It's not about much.
Right.
It's a lot of just amazing, like, shots, very right. isolated shots in that movie. Like, it just yeah. looks, the look of it is what all sci-fi should look like.
Right. And if 2001 is ever played in a theater near your town, a short-term basis, do yourself a favor, go see it.
I would love to see that in a theater.
I saw it at the AFI theater in 70mm.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was unbelievable.
I'm
not advocating. I don't think you need to see that movie on, psychedelic drugs. But if you do, more power to you. I'm sure a lot of people saw that way in 1969.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right.
No question.
I mean, I think 2001 was probably pretty obvious to anyone who started this podcast list. But it is one of those things where... it's sort of like the Grand Canyon, right? You've been to the Grand Canyon.
I haven't.
All right, so you hear about the Grand Canyon. You're like, oh, well, I know what that's about. A giant canyon. I'm sure it's amazing. And then you go and you see it, and you're like, oh, my God. I can't even... you can't express it. Like, you know what? Even though I imagined it was going to be great, I couldn't have predicted what it felt like to be in it.
Right.
2001's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Everyone can see it. everyone can say it's great, and yet at the same time, everyone might internalize the movie differently.
Right.
It just has that type of effect on you.
Yeah, it's more of, it's like, oh, it's not looking at it from an intelligence standpoint, which it is, just right. It's a feeling, it's like a visceral feeling you right. get when you watch it.
And, you know, it's maybe one of the few films ever that's done that beyond sci-fi.
Yeah.
I mean, some pretentious people believe that 2001 is the greatest film of all time. I don't like ranking greatest film of all time. I will never rank a top 10 of all time, everything, all movies list ever. I won't do it. Even I believe this genre that we did, this list today, is probably the most general we've done.
Yeah, I think so.
Although maybe top 10 badass broads was pretty general. Anyways, that's our list for today. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Hope you guys go and see some of these movies.
Go see all these movies immediately. Right.
Especially go see Dark City, because I got a feeling a lot of you had not seen that. And we'll be back. All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.